From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we talk about energy and our environment with Governor Rick Snyder. He's got the Great Lakes on his mind, from Asian carp and beyond.
There are too many invasives today, and I'm afraid there are too many on the way with our current environment, and I want to do something about it.
Plus, helping more kids get education after high school.
You need another credential beyond a high school diploma, whether it's a technical certificate, an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, or beyond.
Plus, double mastectomies. Some women choose this major surgery to keep breast cancer at bay. But are the benefits of that surgery worth the ordeal and the risk? We'll look at an important new study from the University of Michigan. All of that and more on today's Stateside. But first, the news. To Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, the economics of body parts. We speak with a man who studies human anatomy as a commodity. And as we continue our series on higher education, we look at the issue of access. Who is and isn't able to get more education after high school? But first, Governor Snyder delivered another one of what his administration calls special messages earlier today. The governor has done these in the past about special issues like education, transportation, and public safety. This morning, it was all about energy and the environment. Governor Snyder joins us now. Governor, welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to be with you.
We want to get right into this. It's really hard to talk about energy and the environment, Governor, without bringing up a pretty big thorny issue right now here and across the country. That's hydraulic fracturing. We know that is fracking. And you have a lot of environmentalists that oppose fracking because it requires huge amounts of chemicals and water to be pumped into the ground. They say it pollutes groundwater. Now, you're saying we as a state have done pretty well, that we haven't had problems involving fracking because of our regulations. But it still seems that people are pretty wary and nervous of the process. What do you say to reassure them?
Well, I appreciate that, yeah, because a lot of it is getting the right facts out to people and then working together to make sure we're being sensitive about how drilling continues to evolve, and we keep on keeping strict standards up. Michigan's been doing fracking for well over a decade. We frack thousands of wells in our state, and we've never had an environmental problem of any major magnitude. So in many respects, we're a model for fracking done right, where other states have had major issues. But I don't want to stand still. So part of this message was to actually say we're going to partner with the University of Michigan Graham Sustainability Institute. They're going to do a study that involves a broad stakeholder group of industry, environmental groups on the future of fracking. And we're going to be on the steering committee of that to say, we're doing well today, but where are wells going? Where are issues going? How can we continue to get better? And how can we make sure we're doing it right? And if we can't do it right, we shouldn't do it. But if we can do it right, let's do it well and be a role model for the rest of the country.
Let's move over to alternative energy. Proposal 3, of course, as everyone knows who watched television, listened to the radio during the campaign, Proposal 3 would have mandated that utility companies generate 25% of their energy from renewable resources. By the year 2025, you campaigned against the proposal, and it was voted down. And now you say you're going to study the issue beginning next year and make recommendations by 2015. Do you think we could really afford to wait that long to figure out how Michigan will use renewable resources in the future?
Well, we're not waiting. We actually have goals that we're working on now, the 10% goal for 2015 for renewables and a 1% energy efficiency for electrical energy are already in place, and we're doing well on a path there. So what I would say is that the constitutional proposal had two main problems. One is it doesn't belong in the Constitution in terms of limiting us, particularly given there is no federal energy policy. And two, it didn't have any mention of energy efficiency, and a starting point for this discussion should include energy efficiency. So in concept, I'm supporting the concept of increasing our renewables goals and our energy efficiency goals. We need to do that. But let's do it together as Michiganders rather than simply having a small group of people come together to say, here's a ballot proposal. Mm-hmm. So I want to spend 2013 of really gathering facts, gathering information, encouraging all sectors to have their views heard, to come together in a dialogue, and then let's put that together and let's set some new goals between 2014 and 2015. Then let's enact things in statute that really address what year, what are the percentages, and percentages for what, whether it be renewables or energy efficiency.
Let's turn to issues of land now. The state's Department of Natural Resources has the authority to set aside land and make sure biodiversity is preserved. But Senate Bill 1276 would prohibit the DNR from setting aside an area of land specifically for the purpose of maintaining biological diversity. The DNR couldn't make or enforce a rule to do that. In your special message, you talked about taking an ecosystem approach, and you spoke about taking science and economics and merging them in a thoughtful way. So will you sign this legislation?
Well, I'm not a supporter of it, and I'm not sure that it's actually going to pass both houses. So that's one of the things. Quite often you get lots of bills on lots of topics. I'm going to stay focused on an ecosystem approach where it does take into account what is good environmental science, what is good economic values, and how do you balance those in a thoughtful fashion. Because that's part of the point of the message today is we own a lot of land. We own over 4 million acres as the state of Michigan, 10% of our state. And we really haven't had a thoughtful, comprehensive strategy on what lands we should own, why, and what we're doing on them. And we need to get that done, and that's part of the goal. We're going to be working hard on that over the next few months.
I want to continue talking about that land and that land owned by the state. And you spoke about the fact you're worried that there isn't a strategic use for it. What would you like to see? I mean, what, in your view, does strategic use mean? Is it economic? Is it recreational?
The answer is yes, because it is that balance. And what I would say is, if you stop and think about it, there are clearly lands that are truly the unique spots in Michigan that the state owns or has involvement in that we should be absolutely protecting in terms of Quamenon Falls. You know, the rural landmarks are special places, the state parks. So you have one level there. Then the next level is, what are high recreational uses, where we're getting a lot of great use out of that, whether it be people walking trails, whether it be people hunting. And then another section of lands, what are the lands where we're able to say it's good for timber, it's good for other, you know, activities in some fashion? And then are there lands that simply we have no clue as to why we actually own them?
Hmm.
Should we really own them, or could actually the private sector do something more worthwhile in terms of, you know, agriculture, the timber industry, other things that make sense? In exchange for that, if we're able to sell those lands, could we then use those resources to acquire other lands that fit those higher category profiles?
Let's touch on urban farming. You kind of indicated there's been too much talk and not enough action when it comes to urban farming. What does action on urban farming really mean for you?
It could be two or three things, but one example would be is the Right to Farm Bill is very important for the agricultural community, and our ag community is fabulous in the state. But when you get to the urban areas, what are the constructs to say we don't need all the same kind of requirements, or the requirements should change to fit the urban setting? And there's been a lot of different groups that have done some work on this, but we really haven't developed kind of what would be a model. So let's define what these requirements may look like, because, again, this isn't the state setting the rules, but saying what tools could we give local jurisdictions to say, now you can feel good about putting something in place so we can have urban farming going on, because there's been all kinds of studies, there's been all kinds of activities, but let's get some closure on this so people can actually go ahead and do this really kind of cool, interesting stuff, because it can help provide, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables to people in our urban areas. I think we all want to see that.
Yes.
Could be a good use of the lands. It's a win for all of us if we could get this going in a much more effective fashion.
We want to move now to one of our state's most valuable resources, and of course, it's water. You're saying we need to do better on the Great Lakes, and you're going to be in a good position because you were just named co-chair of the Council of Great Lakes Governors. You're calling for a summit in the next year. What would be your agenda for this? What would be your goals?
Well, there are several things I would put on the list. One of the starting points are aquatic invasives. Mm-hmm. We need to do better, not only with the Asian carp, but other things, and that gets into the discussion about what do we do with rivers and canals that come into the Great Lakes? Are there measures that need to be taken to make sure we keep those invasives out? Again, we're relying on this electric fence now in the Illinois context,
right.
And that's not been a great solution. I mean, I have real concerns about that. The other one is the whole ballast water question. Michigan's done a good job. The state of New York has, but we have states with lower standards, as does the federal government. And are there things we can do to have a better discussion to say, here are stronger standards that do make sense that can be effective? Because we do need to do a better job. There are too many invasives today, and I'm afraid there are too many on the way with our current environment, and I want to do something about it.
Some of the goals and proposals you want to see are going to need legislative action and bipartisan action, definitely. How would you go about getting support for these proposals, especially from lawmakers, possibly fellow Republicans, who might say that the environment and energy issues are really not topping their agenda?
Well, if you look at it, a lot of these things tie together, and that's why I did energy and environment together. They're not separate silos. Having a sustainable environment is really important for quality of life in our state, and not just for us, but for our kids. And it's really one of those things that make us much more attractive for people to come set up their businesses to create jobs. So I view it as all tying together, and to the extent we create more and better jobs in Michigan, hopefully we have more economic resources, more ability to go protect more lands in a thoughtful way or our water in a sustainable fashion. So that's where it all ties together, and a lot of it is getting people to move out of kind of the silo mentality of there's an environmental world and an energy world and an economic world. It all ties together, and we need to be thoughtful in balancing all these things and winning together.
Governor Rick Snyder, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Some breast cancer survivors could be getting double mastectomies they don't need in the hopes that it would keep cancer from coming back. A new University of Michigan study says for some survivors, the fear of cancer returning is so strong, they're getting major risky surgery for some peace of mind. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells explains.
The statistics are scary. 40,000 women are dying each year of breast cancer. And if you've survived, it can make medical sense to get that cancer-ridden breast removed. So while you're at it, why not get both breasts removed? I mean, it makes sense, right? More prevention. Actually, no.
Most of the women who got the procedure, it probably was unnecessary to get the second breast removed.
This is Sarah Hawley. She's an associate professor at the University of Michigan's Medical School. She's one of the co-authors of this study. And they found that the vast majority, 70% of women who get double mastectomies, don't need that extra procedure. There is no added prevention. And this is not news. Doctors and patients know that you should only remove both breasts if you've got a genetic indicator or a strong family history of breast cancer. So why are so many women getting risky, painful procedures that they don't need? Hawley thinks it comes down to one reason, fear.
She's worried. She wants peace of mind. She somewhere deep down still thinks, at least I won't have to worry about it or wonder if I should have done that.
But here's why that's bad. Double mastectomies mean double the risk of side effects, infections, much longer recovery times. And Hawley says none of this is surprising. They did this study because they suspected this was going on. In fact, she says even if she took these results to a survivor and said, see, you don't really need these surgeries, it might not change anyone's mind.
I'm not sure that they would, but I think we need to try and at least really get feedback about when they have a misperception about what a particular treatment may do. And then if they go forward and make that decision, I think at some point that's a personal choice, and we may not be able to change that.
But they're going to try. Hawley and her team are putting together a website to help survivors understand why they may not need these surgeries. The site could be live as soon as next year. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
This week on Stateside, we've been examining the cost of higher education in Michigan. We talked to a college graduate who's struggling to pay her student debt 9 years after getting her diploma. And we got advice about ways to avoid incurring mountains of student debt. Today, we shift our focus as we look at access to higher education. Just how are kids doing in making the transition from high school to college? And who has better access to a post-secondary education? How important is it? Joining us for the conversation is Brandy Johnson, the executive director of the Michigan College Access Network, and Nathan Don Burnett. He's with the University of Buffalo, a professor of higher education administration. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Brandy, I'd like to start with you. The goal of the Michigan College Access Network is to boost the percentage of Michigan residents with post-secondary degrees or credentials, and you want to boost that to 60% by 2025. So I'm wondering, where do we stand right now in Michigan in 2012?
We're hovering right around 36% of adults with an associate's degree or higher, and that is just a significant mismatch from what we need to meet the demands of the labor market in Michigan. Tony Carnevale from the Georgetown Center for Education and the Workforce predicts that Michigan will need 62% of its residents to have a college degree by the year 2018 in order to meet the labor market demands. And so we have to do a lot better at making sure Michigan students are going to college and finishing a degree or credential.
With that 36%, could either of you give us an idea, how does Michigan compare with other states? Worse, better, in the middle of the pack? Nathan, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, so nationally what we've found is we're probably somewhere around 40%, give or take. And, you know, states that lead the way are states like Massachusetts. Minnesota is higher than average. The challenge that I think the 60% points out is that none of our states are even at that mark yet.
Yeah.
When we compare ourselves to the rest of the world, which is often the comparisons that we see, what we find is that we were once the most college-educated. And when you look at our adults in the workforce, those particularly nearing the retirement age or middle age, those are more educated on average than other countries around the world. Where we're falling behind is with our youngest cohort of adults.
Where did this come from? What has caused this slipping behind?
One of the challenges, I think, the rest of the world realized that in order to compete in the global marketplace, they were going to have to behave in ways that looked very similar to the way we had once embraced higher education. And they've done it very effectively. And like Brandy pointed out, it isn't that we've fallen behind. We just haven't improved.
Mm.
Now, where we've really seen indications of this for quite some time, and I'd say informally probably as many as 20 years, is that we've had a disconnect between our college-educated population and the workforce opportunities in terms of getting more of our students engaged in science, technology, engineering, and math to fill those jobs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The jobs that are disappearing in Michigan are jobs that were traditionally filled in the manufacturing sector, and those same manufacturers are replacing those jobs with positions that require another credential beyond a high school diploma.
So we aren't just talking about go do your 4 or 5 years and get your bachelor's degree in fill in the blank. We're talking about a wide menu of post-secondary education.
Absolutely. That's one of our mantras, is that college is post-secondary education. And while many of us would close our eyes, think about the word college and picture a 4-year residential, very traditional college, when we say college at the Michigan College Access Network, we refer to any of those accredited programs that result in a degree or a credential that will set you up for success in the labor market.
So would you suggest looking at those kinds of technical certifications as to make you more hireable?
You know, this is a question. I spent a lot of time in high schools, and one of the challenges that they face is trying to really help students find the right path coming out. And for some of them, those technical fields will be important to consider as an option among many. I think we have to recognize that most of those really are requiring some sort of post-secondary education, even if it isn't what we used to think of as post-secondary education. These credentialing programs, those often occur after high school. And so it all falls into that mix. But the other piece that I think is important about that is we have to think differently about the nature of the relationship between individuals and post-secondary education in a 21st century knowledge economy. We really have to think about lifelong learning as a sustained engagement in understanding and growing in your profession. I gave the example of hybrid technology. We don't know what will be around the next corner for the auto industry when we think about technologies that will drive them towards sustainability. And those who work on those automobiles are going to have to come back to school for additional training to continue doing that work, much like we've seen in law or in medicine or any of the professional fields where that sort of currency is expected.
Brandy, your thoughts?
I would agree that those post-secondary technical certifications and credentials are absolutely a piece of the puzzle that is necessary to meet the demands of the labor market, and that students really should, in high school, figure out an initial pathway to a degree or a credential. And if that is the most appropriate match or fit based on their academic preparation, based on affordability reasons, based on their career goals, then absolutely that is a fantastic option and really does set students up nicely for a decent paying
mm-hmm.
job.
Mm-hmm.
But I would agree with Nate that that certainly doesn't limit the possibilities for students once they obtain one of those credentials, continuing their education beyond.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. We're talking today with the problems and challenges of access to post-secondary education, speaking with Brandy Johnson of the Michigan College Access Network and Nathan Don Burnett. He's with the University of Buffalo, and he's a professor of higher education administration. How better could a high school help a youngster with the discernment process of trying to figure out where your life's path is? Because I can tell you, I know these kids who are plodding through courses and hoping that they can kind of find a light at the end of the tunnel that tells them what they ought to be when they grow up.
I think there are a number of things that we can do. We have to rethink the bar that we set. Right now, we expect of high schools that students will complete high school. We haven't yet set the expectation universally that they are going on to post-secondary education.
Okay.
And with that comes some changes in the way we structure that work. So Brandy and I have talked at some length about the role the counselors play. Counselors are critically important in many situations, but very often they don't have the time or the training to really spend helping students make informed choices about the path that they will follow beyond high school. And we've left a lot of that, even in the suburban districts where they have comparably more resources,
yeah.
We leave a lot of that decision and that guidance to parents. It really seems to me that there is a new sort of structure that allows us to work collaboratively between higher ed and high schools in particular to bring more people in who can help students navigate that choice process.
Good point.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In Michigan, the average student-to-counselor ratio is 638-1. Which
yeah.
really blows our minds in terms of thinking about the caseloads of these counselors. I think you're right that high schools need to be very deliberate and intentional about having and executing a college access strategy. You know, bake it into the high school model, put it in the water, that there is an expectation that all students pursue and complete a post-secondary degree or credential.
And they would have to do this kind of mindset and this kind of work with the students probably on no budget because funding is shrinking. So that's kind of a conundrum for if I was a principal, I'd say, well, that's all well and good. Who's going to do that and where am I going to find the money?
If I could respond to
yeah.
that just for a moment. You're right. Schools are absolutely strapped and they don't have the resources. Otherwise, they would hire more counselors.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think there is great potential, and Brandy has done some of this with the National College Advising Corps partnership that they have, but university, community, and school partnerships may be a really vibrant area for that sort of expansion. So one of the things that we're doing here, we're working on a project here in Buffalo creating a college success center, which is part of a larger federal Promise Neighborhood grant. And so we brought in some external resources, including the partnership with the university, to bring paraprofessional staff into the high school to create a space for all of that college choice process to occur independent of the counselor. So we take some of that off of their plates so that they can spend more time counseling. And they don't have to worry about the administrative piece of the college choice process, the filling out the SAT applications or the fee waivers or the application process, the essays,
yeah.
all the things that get left to students alone, we can now do through that center. And I think we can experiment with these new models to see if those collaborative arrangements can supplement what the schools are already trying to do.
Where do both of you think a child could go if the support for school is not there at home? Where could a child go for that support?
I think there are several youth-serving organizations that target the students that we know need the most help. Students of color, first-generation college-going students, students that come from low-income families. And there's numerous touch points where a child can look to for that support. Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Boys and Girls Club, YMCAs, their pastors and faith-based leaders, other teachers or coaches that they have relationships with. So it's really important that all of those adults within a community are on the same page and delivering a consistent message. In Michigan, my organization, the Michigan College Access Network, has worked to establish what we call local college access networks, or LCANs. And the LCANs are just that, a network of adults representing organizations and institutions that have a stake in making sure we increase our educational attainment, and having them agree on a common agenda that all students are college material, that we need to be consistent about making sure there's an expectation for students to pursue college, that college is a necessity to compete in a knowledge-based economy, et cetera, so that no matter who that child or young person turns to, counselor, pastor, coach, teacher, program director, caseworker, they are all delivering the same message that you will be going to college, and here's some resources that I can provide to help you get there.
Go ahead, Nathan. I know you've got thoughts on this.
First, I would agree. Whenever I go into a classroom, the first folks I point to are teachers, because I think sometimes students forget that the most educated people that they run into every day are the teachers who sit in front of them in class. And I like to hold them up as models for, if you want to figure out how to get there, talk to the folks who are talking to you every day. But there are two groups that we're trying to bring into the College Success Center that are in addition to the ones that Brandy already mentioned. One is, and I hadn't thought about this prior to doing this work, was working with alumni of the high schools. We have a pretty vibrant network of folks who have a real commitment to this particular high-need high school in Buffalo that want to give back. And so we're figuring out ways to connect them with students so that they can help provide some guidance on the path. The other group that I think we don't look to enough, and we do more of this in higher ed but less in high schools, is turning to a peer leadership model, empowering peers, seniors within the school to work with their classmates to help them figure out how to navigate the process. And I think there's great potential for that because it doesn't take a lot of resources to make that happen.
That's exciting. I think that I'd like your thoughts about, is there anything that could or should, in your opinion, be done on a policy level that could help get more of these kids into post-secondary education? Is there something we're missing to help bridge this gap?
From my perspective, there are a couple of policy areas that I think we need to stay consistent on or work on. And one is making sure that all students are exposed to an academic curricula in high school that will set them up for success in post-secondary education. The remediation rates for students coming right out of high school as they enter college are astonishingly high. So students need to be able to leave high school and enter college prepared to take that basic college-level, entry-level coursework, English 101, Biology 100, no matter what kind of degree or credential they are pursuing. And in order for them to be prepared, we need to make sure that they have been exposed to a college prep curriculum for all students. So in Michigan, we have very rigorous high school graduation requirements, and we need to make sure that we keep those graduation requirements high. There's been some rumblings in Lansing to roll back those high expectations for all high school students, and I think it's important that we maintain the level of academic rigor that we see now as a mandatory component of high school graduation. As you mentioned, a lot of the series that you've focused on is around student financing and student debt. affordability is absolutely still a barrier to higher education for our lowest income students. And so we have a responsibility at the government level, both federal and state, to ensure that there are scholarships and grants available to low-income students.
And Nathan, your thoughts?
What I would say on the policy front there is the systematic dismantling of financial aid is really problematic for Michigan. Mm-hmm. You know, you've lost many of the programs, and they were never the most generous programs that we've had in the country anyway. So Michigan right now is in the upper half of sticker price in terms of public four-year institutions, and it's on the lower end in terms of financial aid of any type, but particularly in terms of need-based aid. And where we're seeing the most promise now is in the local college access networks and the promise zones, where they're developing local strategies to find the resources. But that leaves some folks out when it comes to affordability, and we've got to find a more systematic approach to supplement that.
Thanks to both of you. We want to let everyone know that we have put links on our website to the Michigan College Access Network, to Brandy's group, and Brandy Johnson, Executive Director of the Michigan College Access Network, and Nathan Dawn Burnett, who's with the University of Buffalo, a professor of higher education administration. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Still to come, the economics of body parts. Yep, we'll speak with an economics professor who studies human anatomy as a commodity. That's in 15 minutes here on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. Around your neighborhood. Chances are getting better. Instead of a forlorn crop of for sale signs sprouting up in yards, those signs have sold stickers on them. Houses are selling again in Michigan and across the country. This year, housing is expected to make the first positive contribution to America's gross domestic product after six long, long years. A common story through the Great Recession here in Michigan, homeowners who wanted to move or sell who were stuck. Now, keep in mind, census figures released earlier this year showed Michigan was the only state to have lost population. And one has to wonder how much worse this out-migration would have been if many of us had not been stuck in homes that were underwater or we couldn't sell. Let's take a closer look at our housing market and the prospects for holding on to Michigan's population as we turn to demographer Kurt Metzger. He's the director of Data Driven Detroit. Kurt, how do you think the sluggish housing market contributed in keeping people here in Michigan who might otherwise have gone elsewhere?
We laughed about that and sometimes thought that maybe that was the only thing that was saving us, that people just couldn't afford to leave and therefore they didn't.
Yeah.
But I think some of that was true, but a lot of it, what happened was that people who were underwater, people who couldn't afford, people who couldn't sell, turned their homes into rentals.
Mm.
So we did see a lot of rental properties, and if you look at the home owner occupancy rate or home ownership rate in Michigan, it has gone down considerably, and has gone down certainly in urban areas, probably more than rural areas. So a lot of people, single-family homes, they couldn't sell. Some of them held on as long as they could and then just had to leave because they couldn't find a job. They would turn their homes into rentals. Others, when the economy started to go down in other parts of the country, then it became even more difficult. It wasn't a matter of you couldn't find a job in Michigan. All of a sudden, the jobs weren't out there at all. Plus, you were underwater, so you basically just held tight and hoped that the economy would turn or that you could find some kind of part-time jobs.
I can absolutely think, I can easily name people I know, people in my family even, that is exactly what happened. And as they started looking beyond and seeing where else they could work, you're right, the situation wasn't much better anywhere else.
That's right.
So they stayed put.
Yes.
Now that things are perking up again, you can. There's a much better chance of doing a refinance to tap into lower mortgage interest rates. Do you think that might affect people's decision to either come back here or to stay here?
Well, I think it will. I think there are a couple of things that are going to happen. I mean, you're starting to see housing demand here. And as they've said, even in Michigan, that the real estate market has the fewer and fewer homes on the market. And so all of a sudden you're starting to see values going up. You know, that those values have been going down for years and years and years. All of a sudden you're seeing values going up. You're starting to see some bidding wars, which is kind of exciting.
Yes.
Bidding wars are a little bit, you know, they're bidding on prices that were lower than they were 3 or 4 years ago, but nevertheless. And as the economy starts to turn also, these young kids who have been hanging out in their parents' basements, all of a sudden they're seeing opportunities to leave. That economy, as the economy starts to turn around, all of a sudden there is a demand for new housing, a demand, new households are being formed. We've even had a lot of stories where, you know, on the negative side, you had couples who were divorcing and yet couldn't afford to separate, so they were staying in the same home, maybe on other opposite sides of the house.
Sure.
But, you know, all of a sudden, those kinds of factors will also lead to additional households. And so the question becomes whether they're going to be in the market for new homes. Are they going to look into some of these vacant homes that are out there? Are they going to drive demand? And so we're starting to see a housing market turning around in terms of both value. So that's going to keep people in their home or start to think about maybe moving up, buying another home because of interest rates and things like that. But also it's going to increase the demand for homes. And a lot of the stories now are that home ownership is less expensive than rental. The rental rates have gone up pretty high. The rental market starts to top out, and it becomes more cost-effective to actually buy. So that's going to drive more demand. And we're starting to see, again, a lot of those subdivisions that were started back in 2007, 2008, with, you know, they were selling like hotcakes, and all of a sudden subdivisions just stopped.
Sure.
Developers are going back into those subdivisions and building. And you're also, fortunately, which is I'm more interested in, is seeing that demand in cities, even Pontiac. I mean, we're hearing a lot of stories about Detroit, but you're hearing that the downtown market in Pontiac is filled. And so there's a real demand from younger people who now are getting jobs, have these opportunities. They want to live in cities, and so cities across Michigan are starting to see the opportunity for reinvestment, that we're going to redevelop, that we're going to do infill housing, different housing options. So I think it's a very – we're seeing some really good stories coming out.
Would you actually put it down on the table and say, Kurt Metzger, that yes, the economy is rebounding, and yes, the out-migration has stopped or reversed? Are we at that point of being able to say that?
Well, I think out-migration is going to be tough to totally reverse. I think, you know, what we're starting to see, you know, obviously as an economy gets better, people start to see opportunities. They're going to stay put, and they're going to start coming here. We still, you know, with all the good stories, we still have to figure out how does Michigan retain its young people, and how does Michigan attract young people, and how do we become more immigrant-friendly, and how do we become a little more, what I worry about is Michigan continues to be kind of stodgy in many ways, and whether it's giving up the film credits or issues around stem cell research or the arguments around gay marriage and abortion rights and things like that, we tend to be kind of conservative. And in many cases, young people are looking for a little different perception, you know, a little different idea. So I think we've got a ways to go. I think we're starting to turn that around. I think Michigan is seen kind of cool. We're very affordable. We have some really interesting places and really interesting opportunities for development and for people to become part of a rebirth of communities. And you can do that at a pretty inexpensive way. And so I think, you know, we're right at that, at crucial, I keep saying, even Detroit, we're at a point where things are starting to look real good. Things are really starting to turn around. You don't want to make the pronouncement that everything is it's sunny from now on. You know, anything could change. Certainly, the global economy, all those kinds of things.
Sure.
But I think we are on an upward trend. I think everything that we're seeing is consistently good. So I'm hoping that we continue to really think about how we work together in communities. I think public transportation and a transportation infrastructure is critical. That's what people are looking for. So there's some more things that we've got to get around kind of working together regionally, across races, across geographies, across a number of other barriers, and show that we can be much more collaborative. That's what young people are looking for. They want to see people working together, and they want to see kind of that progressive view of how Michigan is moving forward. And I think we're getting there. I'm hoping we're getting there, and I think that the signs are very positive. We just got to keep that going.
Kurt Metzger, thanks for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Certainly my pleasure. Thank you.
Kurt Metzger is the director of Data Driven Detroit. Sex, drugs, body parts for cash. Do we have your attention? Well, I say with a healthy amount of chagrin that over here at Stateside, economics professor Adam Lutzger had us at body parts. As part of a special lecture at the University of Michigan Flint this week, Lutzger gave a presentation called Human Body Parts as Commodities. There's quite a theme here: the good, the bad, and the ugly of the free market. How do we as a society decide what's for sale? Why does the idea of selling something like a kidney make us so uncomfortable? We're joined now by Adam Lutzger to explore this debate surrounding so-called contested commodities like human organs. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You gave a presentation this week that pretty similar to a lecture that you give your students. How'd you come up with this idea, and what were you hoping that they get out of your presentation?
Okay, so I actually started it as a teaching strategy to get my students' attention. I realized that I had a lot of students who were both very pro-market, kind of libertarian about standard commodities, but they were also very pro-law and order, so they were against buying and selling lots of things that were illegal. So for right fun, I called those sex, drugs, and body parts.
Sure.
And I was trying to get them confused, basically, to say, how come we have an intuition that it's okay to buy and sell certain things, but not okay to buy and sell other things? What's the difference between one type of potential commodity and another?
What are some of the other contested commodities that you are really interested in that raise ethical and political value questions?
We talked a little bit about stem cells in that talk in the class. This actually grew out of a project at University of Michigan Flint where we had a common read for all the students of this book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Yes.
And
yes.
So her stem cells actually, I think, medical cells
yes.
are taken under the big science regime. They're not patented. The doctor who starts duplicating them actually is giving them away to other researchers. There's a later case in the 70s and 80s of a guy named John Moore that's very famous among lawyers and economists because Moore's doctor does patent the material that he gets from Moore. And Moore finds out about it and actually sues the doctor, thinking that he should be the person who owns his own body. And the interesting court case is it's a California case, and the California Supreme Court actually decides that the doctor should have the property rights in Moore's cells rather than Moore. And the court basically says Moore is just the raw material and his cells weren't valuable in his body.
Ooh.
The doctor is the creative genius who turned the cells into a useful commodity.
Yes.
So the interesting action is the move from common property that we don't give people property rights in to what type of activity you have to do to privatize it and be able to make money off it.
So how, when you started challenging your students, what kind of reaction did you get? How did people get rattled?
Actually, I think it was kind of fun, right? The problem teaching economics is the technical material is sometimes dry to students, and thinking in terms of cases is kind of fun because then they're no longer having to get the right answer. Like, I was sort of fairly clear that there aren't necessarily right answers to these. We change our minds over time, historically. It also shakes people up a little because people who are conservative in one sphere might be liberal in another sphere. And that's more interesting than having people always have the kind of same political responses to things?
Sure. So you could look at sex, for instance, and realize that you could go to Nevada and go someplace that is completely legal that would get you arrested and your name in the paper if you were here.
Right. And right. It's also it's sort of good, I think, intellectually for us to think about, like, why is it that we think in general it's okay for people to buy and sell many things, but we're nervous about people buying or selling sex? We learn a little bit, I think, about what our alternative values are besides market values.
Hmm.
Like, I think the simple answer there is that people think that economic exchanges are somehow impersonal and instrumental, whereas sex is something that's personal and intimate.
Hmm.
And we get nervous about blurring the genres. We sort of have an intuition that these should be separate spheres, in the way that, like, you know, too much commerce within a family might make us nervous if parents start charging their children rent or something like that.
Sure, sure. Let's talk about the current system we have, and let's talk about, we'll call them body parts, all right? We let people sell plasma, but not blood.
Right.
Why is that?
So I think there was a debate in the 1960s where actually economists made the argument that with blood, there can be diseases transmitted in the blood, and if you buy and sell blood, it might lower the quality of the blood supply, because the people who sell blood might be people that need money for, you know, either medical treatments or because they are addicted to certain illegal drugs that can also cause them to get illnesses.
Okay.
So I think it was in part, for some people, some economists, a kind of pragmatic argument about the quality of the blood supply. But for other people, I think it was sort of a social and moral issue that if you give something as gifts, it's part of an ongoing social relationship. So a thought that people owed each other things just as fellow human beings or as fellow citizens. It's kind of the sharing ethic that we teach people in kindergarten.
Sure enough.
And so we motivate donating blood through a kind of obligation of citizenship logic that's separate from a commerce and marketplace logic.
Yes. And you do feel that kind of surge of being a good person. And there's nothing crossing my mind, at least, about money and being compensated. But
right.
I guess that certainly could be something that could play into that. You want a kidney badly enough? I'm a match. What are you going to pay me?
Right. So I think what makes us nervous about that, right, is that we're worried about elements of tacit coercion in the market.
Mm.
That most likely, right, it'll be rich people who buy the kidneys because they'll be fairly expensive. And it will be poor people who will be more likely to sell their kidneys because I think in general, if you have other sources of money, selling part of your body doesn't strike you as a good option.
Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah.
The fact that, because one of the sort of reasons we think market exchanges are usually morally non-problematic is because we think they're voluntary exchanges between people, and we put a lot of weight on the voluntary aspect of it. The more we think about people being coerced into an exchange, the less it feels like a morally good thing to us, and the more it feels like a type of exploitation.
Yes, that makes sense. Now certainly the goal line, if you will, gets moved, because I was just reading about Dr. Joseph Murray, who performed the first successful organ transplant. And that was a kidney transplant. He just passed away this week. Well, that broke incredible ground, but it also brought a firestorm of criticism to something that eventually won him a Nobel Prize, and it's something that is part of our society today. So we do shift, don't we?
Yes, and actually what's counted as a commodity has changed dramatically over time. If you go back more than 500 years ago, even things like land and labor, which we think of as the standard things people buy and sell,
yeah,
those tended not to be commodities for sale. Land used to be conquered and inherited rather than bought and sold. Labor used to be mostly an inherited class position. The aristocracy had children that were aristocrats. The peasants had children that were peasants. So even just learning to buy and sell those was what economists called the development of capitalism. In the 20th century, with new technologies like the organ transplants, it makes new things possible. And so then we have to decide, are we going to allocate private property rights to people to do something? Are we going to treat something as a kind of common property that people share and give gifts? Similar issues come up not just in medicine and technology, but in kind of intellectual or cultural property. So the way the internet has affected our ability to copy music and has led to new issues about how do property rights work and cultural production.
You've done interesting work making economics challenging and intriguing, dare I say, when you do these presentations with your students and just raising questions that maybe have not occurred to most of us. And then you look at it through the eyes of an economist. So you've taught all of us a little something today, Dr. Lutzker.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us today on Stateside. Professor Adam Lutzker is with the University of Michigan Flint as a professor of economics. And here at Stateside, we want to connect with you. We love to hear from you. You can find us online and write to us through michiganradio.org. Go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineer today by Peg Watson. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and we will look forward to joining you tomorrow at 3 o'clock.